Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this lecture sponsored by the Institute of World Politics. For those of you who are new, IWP is a graduate school of national security, intelligence, and international affairs. We offer a doctoral program, 7 master's degree programs, including 2 online MAs, and 18 certificates of graduate study. If you're interested in learning more about us, please feel free to speak to one of our staff at the conclusion of this event, or visit iwp.edu. We'd like to thank all of our supporters who make our IWP events program possible. To support the work of IWP, please visit iwp.edu/donate. And now I'd like to introduce Dr. John M. McCarthy. He's delivering a lecture entitled "The Wagner Group: The Privatization of the Instruments of Power." Dr. John McCarthy is currently the senior program advisor with the U.S. Navy's Only Explosives, Weapons, and Foreign Materiel Technical Exploitation Command. In 2006, Dr. McCarthy was recruited from the private sector by Naval Surface Warfare Center, Explosive Ordnance Disposal Technology Division, and subsequently mobilized as a Naval Reserve Officer to initiate programmatic infrastructure and organizational development for the newly established Technical Support Detachment, the purpose being to specialize in investigating, exploiting, and attacking the IED manufacturing network on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan. The command, renamed Expeditionary Exploitation Unit 1, now spans the globe working with combatant commanders, Special Operations Command, and the intelligence community supporting technical exploitation, technical intelligence collection, counterterrorism, and irregular warfare activities. Prior to his return to active duty military and current federal service, Dr. McCarthy held a senior leadership position supporting business and financial operations at a nonprofit healthcare organization and was a technical business development executive for a global specialty chemical manufacturer serving the industrial sector for over 16 years. In addition, he served as an adjunct professor and part-time faculty of leadership and management and other business and intelligence disciplines for a number of universities since 2004. Educationally, Dr. McCarthy holds a graduate certificate of intelligence studies, an MBA degree, a Master of Science in Strategic Intelligence, and a PhD in organization and management. Always seeking to broaden his knowledge base, Dr. McCarthy remains engaged in continuous learning opportunities and is currently enrolled in IWP's Certificate of Graduate Study program, focusing on statecraft and national security. With that, please join me in welcoming Dr. John McCarthy.
Thank you, Carlos. Can you all hear me? Okay, great. Well, welcome, everyone. Thank you to the Institute of World Politics for the opportunity to speak on this topic tonight, and thank you to all of you for taking time to attend the lecture this evening. And with that, the agenda for tonight. So while you're looking at that, I'd just like to say that a lot has been written about the Wagner Group and its relationship with the Russian Federation, and from a pure academic perspective, which is what this delivery is tonight, the topic is extremely interesting. Yet there's very complex and many unsavory issues associated with Wagner Group and that relationship. But for this lecture, I've elected not to dwell on the darkest elements of PMC Wagner. Instead, focus on the affinity that the Russian Federation has toward outsourcing a not-so-insignificant share of the instruments of power to private military companies like Wagner to advance their national interests. And with that, let's kick it off with a short article that I'd like you to read for me. Just kidding. I'll translate here for you in a second. This article is from the now defunct Russian state news outlet, RIA Novosti. And if you would, just take a minute to read the article, and it will scroll for you. Thank you. So as the article highlighted, we have then Prime Minister Vladimir Putin speaking to the lower house of the Federal Assembly of Russia's legislature in 2012, openly acknowledging the value that private military companies can bring to the Russian Federation, that these entities can facilitate the projection of national interests and power while affording Russia a measure of anonymity suitable to remove any direct involvement by the state. And in that same year, retired Russian military intelligence officer Alexander Kanchukov was quoted in an interview as saying the following, quote, "The main advantages of PMCs appear to be their operational skill, responsibility, effectiveness, professionalism, and undeniable financial advantage. PMCs are an alternative for former soldiers to the state rather than to a life of crime. They guarantee insurance in zones of instability, quick resolutions to problems, and effective administration of risks. It's far more profitable to sign a contract with a private company for a concrete task than to send the security company affiliated with a giant oil or gas company, or send troops to maintain a garrison. On the other hand, if the state does not want to be affiliated with their participation in any conflict or project, or they want to shift other dirty business in war to others, then PMCs will be the excellent performers for these purposes." So as the United States downsizes its military forces in parts of Africa, Middle East, and South Asia, Russia is expanding its influence in these and other areas. And instead of deploying conventional soldiers, Moscow has turned to private military companies like the Wagner Group. Russia's strategy is straightforward: to undermine the U.S. and Western power while increasing Moscow's influence, using low-profile, deniable forces that can do everything from providing foreign leaders with security to specialized training, political advising, and directly assisting partner security forces. Moscow's use of PMCs has grown in recent years, reflecting lessons learned from previous deployments, an increasing interventionist mindset, and a desire for economic, geopolitical, and military gains. Now, PMCs are characteristic of Russian public-private partnerships based on merging of public and private resources with agreed-upon division of risks, responsibilities, and results. Yet PMCs technically remain illegal under Russian law. The Russian government, however, provides PMCs opportunities and protection unavailable to other businesses or individuals. The government, in essence, transfers authority to these private entities as long as they willingly operate according to the state's requirements. Generally, the services that Russian PMCs provide can be aggregated into three categories in support of the Russian Federation's goal for realizing national interest without the direct participation of the state. As you see here, the three categories include, to your left, strategic services, such as diplomatic and political influence of weak or fragile states. Services that support kinetic operations, such as direct action services being applied to the war in Ukraine or Syria or Libya. And services that fall into the gray zone space that are considered hybrid operations, to include acting as diplomatic liaisons in CAR or providing VIP security services and military training in Mozambique, or even conducting information warfare and propaganda campaigns against the West. So for the next four slides that you're going to see are strictly for context. It's how the U.S. imagines the instruments of national power versus the Russian Federation's perspective. For the purpose of this lecture, we'll be focusing on the traditional dime model, recognizing that there are a host of other more inclusive whole-of-government models that can be used to frame U.S. instruments of national power. Primary source for this in the next slide relative to the U.S. comes from U.S. joint doctrine. And one might ask how the U.S. uses dime to project power. Anyone? Well, one example is through its national security strategy. Okay? The national security strategy represents the president's national security vision conveyed to Congress and provides discussion on proposed and synchronous uses of all elements of U.S. power needed to achieve the nation's security goals. The strategy includes a discussion of U.S. international interests, commitments, objectives, and policies, along with defense capabilities necessary to deter threats and implement U.S. security plans. So at the basic level, this is how dime is executed by the U.S. Thank you. So your top right, start there, the diplomatic instrument. Engagement and peaceful coexistence are the hallmarks of diplomacy. The U.S. achieves this by continually assessing another country's power potential, its perceived vital interests and relationships with other states, which in turn maximizes our own freedom of action to further national goals and interests. The information instrument. Information can be both an instrument and a source of national power. It's an instrument when used to shape events, strategies, national will, and international perceptions. It's a source when possession of specific information achieves a comparative advantage, enabling our leaders to shape or react to national and world events. The military instrument. Fundamentally, the military instrument is coercive in nature, to include the integral aspect of military capability that opposes external coercion. Coercion generates effects through the application of force, to include the threat of force, across a range of military options, to compel an adversary or prevent the U.S. from being compelled. And then the economic instrument. The U.S. can choose a variety of methods in applying economic power. Trade policies can open up or deny markets to nations. The U.S. can restrict foreign organizations from raising funds or prohibit U.S. companies from doing business with state sponsors of terrorism or transnational criminal organizations. Foreign aid can be used to entice nations to act favorably toward the U.S., while sanctions can be employed to deter or alter objectionable behaviors or policies to further national security or foreign policy objectives. Now, Winston Churchill was once famously quoted as interpreting and comprehending Russia's intricate political, cultural, and historical landscapes as a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. Churchill's statement captures the challenges of understanding the complexities and idiosyncrasies of Russia's intentions from a national security perspective. However, since the time of Churchill, scholars and analysts have come to realize that Russia's objectives on the international stage, and certainly in the era of Putin, have focus. These objectives seek to achieve an uncontested sphere of influence in the near abroad, global influence on Russia's terms, and seek to constrain U.S. freedom of action. Russia's approach to power projection is hybrid, both direct and indirect. The approach emphasizes building the military means necessary for direct competition and then leveraging direct approaches to enable indirect methods for pursuing state objectives. Indirect means include military deployments abroad to peripheral theaters, covert action, use of proxies in private military companies, the use of political and economic warfare, and information confrontation. The indirect approach is a primary method by which Russia pursues political aims. So let's take a look at some of the specifics associated with Russia's hybrid approach to power projection. We'll overlay this on the traditional dime model. So just like before, your top right, please, the diplomatic instrument. Now, one of Russia's most significant instruments in its strategic toolbox has been its capacity to use creative diplomacy to pursue geopolitical opportunities in regions of conflict and national interest. Russia's approach to exploiting regions of conflict and national interest is often coercive and illusory, a strategic mix of hyperactive hard power, deceptive soft power, and confrontational diplomacy. The information instrument. Russia recognizes the importance of the information space to modern warfare. General Valery Gerasimov, Russia's chief of the general staff, has articulated a geopolitical strategy that emphasizes the importance of information warfare, noting that, quote, the information space opens up wide asymmetrical possibilities for reducing the fighting potential of the enemy. It's Russia's goal to weaken the perception of the United States so that allies do not trust either U.S. abilities or motivations. The military instrument. Russia's leaders have taken steps to prepare the country for the possibility of direct military confrontation with an adversary. Putin has stated, however, that the likelihood of a global war of nuclear powers against each other is low, and that no one would dare unleash large-scale aggression against the Russian Federation, which is why indirect hybrid methods take center stage as the driving force in international competition with Russia's adversaries. And in this context, Russia prefers to use ambiguity in its actions and messaging to slow down adversary decision-making processes. Ambiguity preserves plausible deniability, both domestic and international. And the economic instrument. In a hybrid environment, Russia's most important economic tools have become its energy resources, its arms exports, and the ability to move money and resources through shadowy, opaque networks. When Russia's been successful leveraging its economic tools, the Federation has typically increased a vulnerable country's dependence on Russia's recurrent support to include direct funding, energy deals, security services, military arms, as well as political and social policy intervention, all which facilitate Russia having a say in a country's policymaking, while serving to undermine U.S. and Western influence in the region. So when Russian Parliament Representative Alexei Mitrofanov engaged Prime Minister Putin in 2012 over the creation and legalization of private military companies in Russia, Mitrofanov was reflecting on the PMC experience globally, specifically with respect to the U.S. and the myriad of services a PMC could provide. Putin was quick to realize the utility of PMCs as part of a hybrid extension of Russian geopolitical activity and power projection, in spite of Russian law prohibiting their existence under Article 359 of the 1996 Russian Criminal Code. Putin realized that because PMCs are not legally registered organizations and do not pay taxes to the state, they're not recognized as a Russian entity, and therefore, under Russian law, do not officially exist, making their deniability and ultimately the lack of state accountability for their actions a very attractive proposition. Quietly, and without a lot of fanfare, the modern Russian PMC began to take root, to be used by the Russian Federation as a tool of irregular warfare to exploit instability around the world in pursuit of Russia's geopolitical, military, and economic goals. In 2014, a unique PMC emerged, financed by Russian oligarch Yevgeny Prigozhin, a longtime associate of Putin, and commanded by Dmitry Yukin, a former lieutenant colonel with the main intelligence directorate of the armed forces of the Russian Federation, most widely known as the GRU. These two men, with their network of contacts and links to the Kremlin, Russian Ministry of Defense, Federal Security Service, and Foreign Intelligence Service, were in a perfect position to take the execution of DIME on behalf of the Russian Federation to the next level. So why did the Russian Federation outsource DIME to the Wagner Group? Well, there were some compelling features, advantages, and benefits. To start, Putin and Prigozhin had known of each other and had a relationship since the mid-1990s. Both were sons of St. Petersburg. Prior to their meeting, Prigozhin lived a life of crime, spending a good portion of his 20s in prison. Following his release from prison in 1990 and the subsequent collapse of the Soviet Union, Prigozhin became an entrepreneur, acquiring supermarkets and opening restaurants. One of the restaurants, named the Old Customs House in St. Petersburg, turned out to be a Putin favorite. Now, just like with other PMCs, plausible deniability played a key role in Russia's calculus with Wagner. PMC Wagner was created to be the riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. It wasn't until 2022 that Prigozhin admitted to being at the head of Wagner. Wagner's commanders also had the reputation of being quite disciplined and never invoking the name Wagner or admitting that Wagner had an official role in any foreign activity. Vitaly Perfilev, the head of military operations for Wagner in the Central African Republic and a top security advisor to President Touadera, once stated, quote, "Wagner is a myth that was invented by the journalists, but we really don't care how you call us. You may call us Wagner, Mozart, Schubert, Chopin, Stravinsky. It doesn't change the meaning. We are instructors with the aim of helping countries in need. As a matter of fact, operatives anywhere in the world would never refer to Wagner by name or even acknowledge their existence, instead referring to the organization they were associated with as the orchestra." Another motivation for using PMCs, and especially Wagner, due to its sheer size and numbers, is that it permits the Russian state to conceal personnel losses. As PMCs are private companies, their losses do not count in the official Russian Ministry of Defense, or MOD, reports of how many military personnel have died or been injured. And additionally, it was clear to Putin that Prigozhin had been thinking ahead. Prigozhin knew that he could not cover every contingency with PMC Wagner, and being a businessman, leveraged the advantages that teaming agreements bring to a prime organization. He partnered with other PMCs and front companies, taking advantage of their core competencies and overhead, while embedding some of his capabilities into the companies to hide intent. These Byzantine networks were of great interest to the Russian Federation. And finally, Prigozhin's Concord Group. And one can imagine the conversation Prigozhin had with Putin over what he could bring to the table with Wagner, coupled with the civilian side of his economic enterprise. With Concord, Prigozhin maintained many of the businesses, modalities, and capabilities necessary to export dime, while simultaneously expanding his own interests. Among the modalities directly of interest to the Russian Federation would be Concord's ability to create front and shell companies and move money around to hide their activities, its mining and oil operations, and the Internet Research Agency, a company created to engage in online propaganda and influence operations on behalf of Russian business and political interests. Although not all-inclusive, we're going to take a look at a select six associates of Wagner who are currently playing or have played a key role in executing dime on behalf of the Russian Federation. So starting with your top left, Dmitry Ukin, former GRU intelligence officer and co-founder of Wagner Group along with Prigozhin. While Prigozhin was the finance and face of the company, Ukin was the operational commander. PMC Wagner's name reportedly comes from Ukin's old call sign, Nom de Guerre, referencing Richard Wagner, the 19th century composer. Prior to co-founding Wagner, Ukin worked for PMC Moran Security Group, a private company founded by Russian military veterans. Ukin was killed in the same plane crash that took the life of Prigozhin on August 23, 2023. Andrei Troshev, retired Russian colonel, veteran of the Soviet-Afghan War, Second Chechen War, and Syria, served in riot police under the National Guard of Russia. A senior commander and executive director at Wagner, managed Wagner's logistics and military operations in Syria. Was selected by Putin to lead Wagner after Prigozhin's rebellion. Reports have indicated he's now a member of the Russian Ministry of Defense with cognizance over Wagner fighters and other PMC relationships working directly for the MOD. Ivan Maslov, Wagner Group senior security official tasked by Prigozhin and Ukin to lead Wagner units in Mali. According to the U.S. Treasury Department, Maslov is a key facilitator in Mali, overseeing mining deals for direct payment to Wagner, securing arms and military equipment to support Russia's operations in Ukraine, managing logistics requirements for incoming Wagner forces, and facilitating and arranging meetings between Mali's leader, Colonel Goita, other African government officials, and Prigozhin. Bottom left, Alexander Ivanov, public-facing spokesperson for Wagner in the Central African Republic. As head of the Officers' Union of International Security, which is a Wagner front company for their military advisor and assist mission, he acts as the official representative of Russian specialists working in CAR. Ivanov is a de facto diplomat, repeatedly being honored by government officials of the CAR. According to his own bio on the OUIS site, he's a combat veteran with 33 years of service in the Russian military, graduating from the Combined Arms Academy of the Armed Forces of the Russian Federation and the Military Academy of the General Staff. Igor Mangushev, founder of ENOT Corporation, a PMC that predates Wagner. He later worked as one of the internet trolls at the infamous Prigozhin-owned and operated Internet Research Agency, or IRA, in 2013. At some point, he was a political advisor to Prigozhin for disinformation operations. He reportedly took part in CAR's civil war in 2018, and fought in the invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Ingushev was assassinated at a checkpoint in Kadivka, Ukraine, February 2023. And finally, Dmitry Sitti. Sitti is Wagner's head of information operations in the Central African Republic. Sitti's background is atypical for many Wagner personnel in that he has no combat or military experience. He studied international trade and business and studied abroad in France before working for the Internet Research Agency. Later, Sitti was used as the official founder of Lobe Invest, the commercial company Wagner set up to extract resources from Carr. He's fluent in Russian, English, and French, and which paired with his experience with the IRA put him in a unique position to run information operations. Sitti was known to be affiliated with Russia House, in Carr, the diplomatic and soft power organization of the Russian government. Sitti survived an assassination attempt by mail bomb in December 2022. After his recovery in Russia, it's been reported that Sitti has resumed his role in Carr with even closer diplomatic ties to Tuadera's government and political apparatus. Okay, so the next couple of slides, and this is in timeline format, will illustrate key events in Wagner's history, reflecting on the execution of Dime on behalf of the Russian Federation. Now, the following that I'm going to show you is only a small representative sample of Wagner's activities. So Prigozhin sets up the Internet Research Agency, or IRA, in 2013 to exploit the rapid rise of social media for influence operations. The agency employed fake accounts registered on major social networking sites, discussion boards, online newspaper sites, and video hosting services to promote Kremlin's interests in domestic foreign policy, including in Ukraine, Africa, Middle East, as well as attempting to influence the 2016 U.S. presidential election. By 2015, estimates are more than 1,000 employees work for IRA, many working out of the building you see here. As viewed from the Dime model, the IRA represents projection of the information instrument of national power to exploit divisions in societies across the globe. May 2014, PMC Wagner is founded to support Little Green Men, Russian GRU and Spetsnaz Special Forces, operating in the Donbass region of eastern Ukraine. Russia first deployed Wagner in Ukraine at a time when the Kremlin needed to fight a covert war, hide their casualties from the Russian public, and mitigate the international consequences of a gross violation of a neighboring state's sovereignty. By employing PMC Wagner in Ukraine, Russia nominally reduced the number of active duty personnel and at the outset concealed their presence militarily. The recruitment of Wagner by the Russian Federation happened quickly in 2014, with the Kremlin turning to Wagner to finance the effort. Additionally, the IRA was involved in early 2014 as part of an effort to characterize the Ukrainian government as fascists and neo-Nazis, in part to lend credibility to the 2014 invasion. Dmitry Yukin was reported to have led Wagner's deployment to Donbass. The information and military instruments of power projection were clearly on display at this time. May to December 2014, Prigozhin, through his Concord Management and Consulting LLC, starts funding Project Lakhta and its translator project against the U.S. political system. IRA is used to support the project. Project Lakhta was an information warfare project in which the Russian personnel set up false social media profiles, stole U.S. identities, and even organized political demonstration events in order to sow discord. It's been reported that Project Lakhta and the Translator Project mission conducted 70 or more online propaganda initiatives against the U.S. between 2014 and 2016. In 2023, Prigozhin admitted to owning and managing IRA, stating, quote, "I was never just a financier of IRA. I invented it, I created it, I ran it for a long time. The IRA and its mission was created to protect the Russian information space from the boorish, aggressive propaganda of anti-Russia assertions from the West." Now, thinking back to what we discussed earlier, Project Lakhta clearly supports General Gerasimov's interpretation of the appropriate application of information warfare and its asymmetrical possibilities. Late October 2015, Wagner deploys troops to Syria as oil refinery defense forces and ISIS fighters in support of Assad's government in its civil war. Russia looks to be settling for an endgame in Syria that stakes its claim on key strategic assets while yielding power and influence in areas beyond its control. The Syria strategy is informed by the so-called Primakov Doctrine, which is named after Yevgeny Primakov, a former foreign and prime minister. The Primakov Doctrine states that a unipolar world dominated by the United States is unacceptable to Russia. One of the key features of the doctrine is the establishment of a multipolar world with major powers seeking to counterbalance the United States. Now, Syria is one of the regions of multipolar interest to Russia, with Wagner Group serving as a key facilitator. Wagner's presence in Syria assists in achieving multipolarity by protecting the Assad regime's power during conflict and cultivating trust in the process, by facilitating diplomatic relations between the Assad government and Russia through the promise of long-term cooperative security agreements, securing military bases for the Russian Federation, and opening the door for long-term oil revenue and exploration contracts benefiting both Russia and Wagner. Evidence of the diplomatic, military, and economic support to the Russian Federation's projection of power are certainly evident in Syria. Now, an example of the effectiveness of IRA and Project Lacta's translator project are on display in 2016. An anti-Trump protest entitled "Trump is Not My President" attracts 5,000 to 10,000 protesters in Manhattan who march from Union Square to Trump Tower. The protest is organized by the IRA using their Black Matters US Facebook account. Now, the image you see here is a screenshot of what was reported to be a contract between Wagner Group and Syria for payment to Wagner for liberating oil and gas production facilities from ISIS. In this case, Prigozhin's Evropolis, a subsidiary under Concord Management Consulting, will receive 25% of all proceeds from facilities operated by Syrian state-owned General Petroleum Corporation. Contracts like these have, among other things, opened up Russian diplomatic talks with the Assad regime for long-term support to Syria, while also highlighting the projection of military support as a bridge to securing an economic return on investment. And similar to the interests Russia has in Syria, taking advantage of a fragmented and chaotic Libya meets all of the Russian Federation's power projection objectives, with Wagner initially playing a key role. Wagner's military support to General Khalifa Haftar's LNA forces in early May 2018 was key to conveying Russian diplomatic support to a potential leading candidate for president in Libya at some point in the future. Economically, intervention in Libya focuses as much on securing long-term investment opportunities as it does on retaining Haftar as a loyal appendage to Russia. Russia's long-term efforts focus on controlling Libya's resources and reestablishing Gaddafi-era business deals. Wagner indirectly influences these opportunities by fomenting instability and infrastructure distress, allowing Russia to secure lucrative nationwide reconstruction contracts, such as a $2 billion Benghazi to Sirte railway line. Russian information operations in Libya feature a variety of traditional and social media platforms, with evidence of coordination between the two. Russia supports at least two local broadcast television networks and one print newspaper. Prigozhin's IRA initiatives have leveraged Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to promulgate Russia's propaganda. Along with Russia's diplomatic efforts, IRA had been active in supporting Haftar's political ambitions, as well as Muammar Gaddafi's son, Saif, who, in hedging their bets, was propped up by Wagner and Russia to be a potential rival to Haftar. December 2018. Media articles circulate revealing that Valery Zakharov has an office in the presidency of CAR as the national security advisor to President Tuadera. Zakharov is simultaneously a Wagner employee and official Russian diplomat. And a Wagner employee. And at one point, Zakharov negotiated a deal with rebel groups in CAR, essentially paying off the rebels with a percentage of revenue from the mines Carr turned over to Wagner as payment for their services. In 2018, he repeatedly stated in interviews that Wagner was not on the ground in Carr, even though he was co-located in country, acting as both security advisor and directing Wagner strategy. Zakharov was sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury for his activities in January 2023. Now, Wagner's arrival in Mozambique in September 2019 came on the heels of Mozambican President Philippe Nyusi's visit to Moscow in August of that year. That trip led to several bilateral agreements between Russia and Mozambique relating to mining, mineral resources, energy, defense, and security. Although significant opportunities presented themselves for Wagner and Russia in this situation, this example is a case of Wagner not fully meeting expectations. So Wagner deploys troops and equipment to Mozambique in Southeast Africa after being selected by the government in a highly competitive bid process. Wagner's role initially is to provide security services for upcoming elections. But when insurgents from Alsuna Waljama, or ASWJ, begin an uptick in violence against Mozambique's security forces, PMC Wagner is tasked by the government to train forces and conduct counterinsurgency operations in northernmost province of Cabo Delgado in exchange for exclusive rights to several gas fields. Wagner is ill-prepared for this mission and loses 12 of its 200 mercenaries within 2 months, with no positive gains to speak of. Essentially, Wagner failed to successfully integrate with and train local forces. Wagner is forced to withdraw from the insurgent-controlled region and sent back to Nacala, 250 miles south of Cabo Delgado, to primarily conduct information operations. In early 2019, sources reported that PMC Wagner had signed contracts with Nicolas Maduro to provide him security as he was facing protests connected to what was considered fraudulent elections by opposition leadership. Approximately 400 Wagner mercenaries arrived in Venezuela, some of whom had transited through Cuba. This was the first known presence of the Wagner Group in the Western Hemisphere. In addition to security for Maduro, Wagner Group was identified as being hired to train elite Venezuelan combat units, along with training pro-Maduro militias alongside Colombian guerrillas. Wagner Group is contracted to protect oil refineries while providing personal security for Russian commercial entities. Wagner also provides a heavy security presence at thorium mining extraction points, where access to this radioactive chemical element is of prime importance to Russia and Iran, both countries having been granted rights to the mines by Maduro. Now, Wagner Group has pursued the same playbook in Mali that it previously executed in Sudan and Carr, which is based on creating dissatisfaction with the West regarding security, military, and anti-terrorism operations. Wagner's three-pronged strategy in Mali involves disinformation and pro-government information warfare strategies, including false polling and counter-demonstrations. Securing payment for services through concessions and precious metal mining operations, and becoming involved in Mali's military structure and operations, opening the door for a direct relationship with Russia's military. Of note, in May 2021, Wagner begins an information operation on social media to gain support for Wagner in Mali. It also serves to encourage postponement of elections to support Russia as an alternative to France. France ultimately leaves Mali in August 2022, ending a 9-year security operation at the center of the Sahel. And in September 2021, Wagner finalizes a deal with Mali's military junta to be paid nearly $11 million per month for services, along with securing extraction rights to three mineral mines. And in a win for Russian influence in an African country, and validation to some degree for the utilization of Wagner as an effective model for power projection, a propaganda statue in honor of PMC Wagner is erected in Bangui City Square in Central African Republic. Carr President Touadera personally unveiled the newly erected statue, standing on a red carpet with crowds of locals observing the ceremony. Coverage of the statue unveiling appeared in local media outlets and was also widely covered in the Russian media. And after successful Wagner IRA information operations in Burkina Faso, Captain Ibrahim Traoré was named as leader after the second military coup in September 2022. Traoré's supporters cheered in the streets, waving Russian flags. Ghana President Akufo-Addo, speaking at a U.S.-Africa summit in Washington, D.C. in December of the same year, stated that Burkina Faso had made a deal with the mercenary group. Akufo-Addo said, quote, "Today Russian mercenaries are on our northern border. Burkina Faso has now entered into an arrangement to go along with Mali in employing the Wagner forces there." Burkina Faso relinquished a gold mine near its border with Ghana in exchange for the group's services to deal with the militant insurgency that began in 2015. Now, emphasizing the perceived value Wagner has brought to Burkina Faso, Interim President Traoré met with Vladimir Putin in July 2023 as part of a discussion on furthering diplomatic, military, and economic ties. Soon after that meeting, Burkina Faso signed a deal with Russia for the construction of a nuclear power plant to increase the country's energy supply. And as if on cue, Russia reopened its embassy in Burkina Faso in December 2023 after having closed it more than 30 years ago. And this final point on the timeline will serve to sum up Wagner's support to the Russian Federation as a tool for conducting dime abroad. And we'll focus on Africa, as this is where Wagner spent most of his time and resources. The hub for Wagner in Russia and Africa is certainly Central African Republic, a country where Wagner has significant success executing full-spectrum dime. Yet even before Carr in 2018, Wagner found themselves in Sudan a year earlier, providing training to the Sudanese military and security to gold, uranium, and diamond mines. From there, Wagner rapidly expanded its presence across the continent through a mix of political, information, military, and economic activity. And where PMC Wagner proper could be found, Wagner affiliates such as Miro Gold, Karoma Mining, and Lobe Invest would soon follow to extract mineral wealth and ship it back to Russia. As mentioned, Wagner is and was active in Libya and Mali. Wagner has provided support to political campaigns in Madagascar, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Equatorial Guinea, and has interfered politically in Zimbabwe. As discussed, Wagner has successfully courted the ruling junta in Burkina Faso, Africa's fourth largest gold producer. PMC Wagner and affiliates control Cameroon-based company International Global Logistics, which handles the transit of Wagner materiel through the port to and from Car. Wagner was originally a client of the company, but now effectively owns it. Wagner operates in and influences the government of Cameroon. In 2022, Cameroonian President Paul Biya signed a training and information sharing contract with Russia on a trip to Moscow. Wagner would provide those services. And the list goes on. So the question becomes, is Wagner, as a tool of power projection on behalf of Russia, a sustainable model? On June 23rd, 2023, Prigozhin withdrew his fighters from the Ukraine front line to challenge the Russian government. Wagner mercenaries had just secured the city of Rostov-on-Don, a key military outpost, 400 miles across the border from Ukraine. Prigozhin and his troops sped toward Moscow, coming to within 125 miles of the city, before agreeing to send his troops back to the front line. Quote, "They, the Ministry of Defense, wanted to disband the Wagner military company," said Prigozhin at the time. "We embarked on a march of justice on June 23. Now the moment has come when blood could be spilled. Understanding the responsibility for the chance that Russian blood will be spilled on one side, we are turning our columns around and going back to field camps as planned." Now the Russian MOD, not comfortable with the disconnect between the entities, had long wanted to pull Wagner completely under its control. Prigozhin resisted. He also had a long history of criticizing the MOD for everything from a lack of material support to a lack of military vision and creativity. And what appeared to be the last straw facilitating Prigozhin's march on Moscow was a supposed Russian MOD sanctioned attack on a Wagner camp Prigozhin accused Russian forces of launching a rocket attack that killed Wagner forces, allegedly triggering Prigozhin's plan to bring the fight to the heart of Russia. 6 days later, Prigozhin would die in a plane crash on his way to St. Petersburg, supposedly having left a meeting with key MOD officials in Moscow. 9 others died in the crash, including Dmitry Utkin. The definitive cause of the crash remains speculative, although many believe the crash to be the result of state-sponsored retribution for the most serious mistake Prigozhin ever made in his life.
Have in common, they all have some ties with the Wagner Group, which has helped increase Russia's influence in Africa. So what happens now that Prigozhin is presumed dead? It's an uncertain period, especially for thousands of Wagner operators active in Mali in the Central African Republic. Prigozhin died days after he appeared in the video when he claimed to be in the Sahel fighting Islamist militants. Some commentators suggest that many mercenaries will go back to operating from the shadows, just like they did before the war in Ukraine. Both Mali and the CAR rely heavily on the Russian mercenaries for their security. Wagner fighters have been in the CAR since 2018, fighting rebels who are responsible for chronic instability. President Faustin Tordera, who invited them, has even been seen in public with Wagner mercenaries as part of a security detail. Over in Mali, the military leaders allowed 1,000 Wagner mercenaries to help the army fight IS and Al-Qaeda. Mali has grown close with Russia, ending a security deal with France, which had 5,000 troops in the region for nearly a decade. It also asked the UN to withdraw more than 13,000 personnel from the country. If the Wagner group also leaves these countries, it could increase instability there. The Wagner Group's business model is to offer its services in exchange for more wealth and strategic economic and military investments. And for developing countries like Mali and the CAR, this has meant giving the mercenaries lucrative deals. A senior Wagner commander was sanctioned by the US for using Mali to purchase weapons for Russia's war efforts in Ukraine. The Wagner Group has also been instrumental in spreading Russian influence in parts of Africa by discrediting the West. However, it's unlikely that this relationship will change. Until recently, the Kremlin denied links with the mercenaries. However, following Prigozhin's rebellion against Putin, Russian officials pledged to continue security arrangements with Mali and the CAR. This highlighted the importance of these two countries to Russia's foreign policy agenda in Africa. Who will lead Wagner Group operations now? It's a question many are asking, but at the moment, it's not clear who will take over the Wagner Group. It's likely to be a hand-picked leader, more obedient to the Kremlin. However, in Mali and the CAR, the mercenaries have their own commanders, which allowed them to operate almost independently while remaining loyal to Prigozhin. What we might see is a possible Wagner Group splintering, which could compromise the range of their operations.
So what's represented on this slide is the myriad of Russian PMCs and volunteers supporting the Russian Federation's global objectives. Reports have surfaced indicating that the Wagner Group is in fact splintering, and in some cases being rebranded as something more closely resembling elements under the direct control of the state, whether the Ministry of Defense or the Kremlin. Wagner appears, albeit temporarily, to still have relevance as a named PMC. To what extent, for how long, is still unknown. Members of Wagner have been offered the opportunity to sign contracts to work directly for the MOD. Others have been offered the opportunity to matriculate into the Russian National Guard, supporting directly the Kremlin. While still others have been offered the opportunity to sign contracts with other PMCs who work directly for the Ministry of Defense. But what of Wagner's leadership? So a few weeks ago, UK Defense Intelligence issued this communique as part of an update on Ukraine, I don't know if you're going to be able to read it from way back there, but if you could, just take a minute and read their announcement. Antonia Lizaroff. Lizaroff is a former decorated military officer and had been one of Wagner Group's senior commanders. After the death of Pogrosian, rumors were that Lizaroff had become the organization's new commander. However, the communications arm of Wagner denied it. The official telegram channel called Wagner Orchestra stated that although Lizaroff manages the combat and training work of the company, he had not been appointed as head of Wagner. Since then, recent news articles have acknowledged Lizaroff as the new field commander and have him quoted as saying, quote, "We continue to work on the African continent. We continue to work in Belarus. We continue to work for the good of Russia. We are working successfully. I am located at the group's headquarters in Cossack camps. We are building a camp so that the new units that will be formed, which will become part of the volunteer corps of the Russian National Guard, can arrive and settle." Lizaroff went on to say that the organization has always defended, are defending, and will defend the people of the Russian Federation and the interests of the Russian Federation. And we will do this anywhere in the world. And I will leave you with this one final quote from General Gerasimov. And that is all I have for you this evening. Thank you.
So at this time, we have time for maybe two or three questions. So does anybody have a question? Please state your name and affiliation.
My name is Matthew Potlock with the U.S. State Department contractor.
Yes, sir.
I had two questions regarding, first question I want to ask you is, with Pogrosian dead and Wagner more under MOD's control than ever before, is Russia looking for a replacement that allows them more separation between the PMC's group actions and the state's actions? And the second question I wanted to ask is, are other countries trying to copy Russia's success with Wagner? And I'm thinking like of China's Belt and Road project. It's been so successful for China. Are they using contractors to do that?
No, great questions. To both questions, I don't have any facts at this point to share with you on those fronts. I only have assumptions. As I mentioned, PMC Wagner is a named PMC. It's still not been dissolved. There's been no traffic, no reporting that I've been able to discover that has changed that. So that's a good question, right? Does Russia want to remain retain that option to separate themselves from a PMC that can do the dirty business of war, right? And still walk away from something if it turns south? I would say yes. I would say that this is in flux. I don't believe that what's happening now with Lizaroff taking over as field commander, he's kind of pulling things together and is kind of the voice right now, making it more formalized, falling under the Russian National Guard. But I believe firmly that Russia will use every tool in the toolbox to try to provide ambiguity, right, to the battle space and achieve their national interests. So that's just my speculative guess, but I do believe that they will try to continue with PMC, as long as they can obviously have some kind of control. The thing about the PMCs under Russia, from what I understand, is that there's always that chance if something goes south, they'll be cut loose, right? So I think Russia likes that feature, advantage and benefit. You mentioned about other PMCs, other countries. I mean, look what the U.S. did. So, and I'm not going to get into we're talking about Blackwater and all that kind of stuff. We're not going to talk about that, in specifically. But I will say that the U.S., when we were successful using PMCs, or private military companies, other countries took note. Russia took note. And that's what they did. They tried to build their PMC repository, if you will, based on what they saw the U.S. doing. And so Alexander Konchubkov, that first quote that I had provided you all, he looked at it like, hey, we have observed what's going on in the world, and we think that PMCs can be successful. Professionalism, all these different things that he described. I think other countries can and will be doing the same thing. I've read some information on China kind of following suit. Others will probably follow suit as well, if they have the resources to do it. But again, Russia's law is that they don't recognize private mercenary companies, right? So as long as that law is in place, they will swear that, they have no control over them. Other countries, I'm not so sure, will follow that same pattern. Does that help?
Yeah, that's excellent.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Yes, sir. Oh, sorry.
Thank you. Eddie Becker, a documentary filmmaker. At least two-thirds of the country you pointed out, especially in Africa, are all challenged by Islamic fundamentalists. If this Wagner Group should implode, what will happen in those countries?
It's a very good question. And what I don't have the answer to that, and maybe somebody here has a better situational awareness on what could happen if Wagner Group disintegrates and leaves Russia, leaves Africa. I will say this, that Russia has put together what they call Africa Corps. Have you heard that? That is the agglomeration of former Wagner employees, mercenaries, coming together under the Russian MOD to support the various countries that they've been in up to this point, and really under more Russian control. So I think Russia recognizes that if they back out, they leave a vacuum. And so they have developed this Africa Corps to replace what was once Wagner, to make sure that there's stability in the countries that they've gained so much ground in.
Has Africa Corps got tanks like Rommel?
Yeah, so that was that's been something floating around in the news. Did that answer your question, first of all,
sir? Well,
sorry.
It would create a vacuum. Would the United States have to, or some other force, have to go in to help these countries?
So I would say that, the UN pulled out because the new regimes that took over during the coups were influenced by Russia, and they threw out the UN, and they threw out the UN security forces. And then Russia stepped in and filled the void, right? But the UN did not necessarily want to leave, but they saw the writing on the wall. I'm fairly sure that if Russia left and created a power vacuum, I'm sure that the UN would be more than happy to go back to its previous role of trying to stabilize Africa.
Yeah, and that's one of the detriments. I'll have you your question here in just a second, but that's one of the detriments, right? So when one leaves a country, you leave it open for any other country to come in and try to stabilize it. Russia has done a lot in the countries that I mentioned here tonight. And for them to leave would be catastrophic, I think, for those countries. I think one of the ties to Russia staying is how they're paid, right? Through the mines, gold mines, uranium mines, these types of things. That ties Russia to these countries. It's very lucrative, in the billions and billions of dollars lucrative, right, for them to remain.
So the logical question, next question is, does it make sense for them to remain there and resist this fundamentalist onslaught?
I think it has made sense. I mean, that's what they were up against when they filled the vacuum to begin with. There's a corridor across the center of Africa, the Ku Corridor, right? And Russia's has done a good job of taking advantage of those destabilized countries. And so I think that they have invested and intend to stay in these countries.
So is that in the interest of the United States for them to stay?
That's where's my State Department?
So what I've
yes.
What I've typically seen in my 13 years in Ukraine is relative to other conflicts is what the interest, there's a multiple thing. Russia doesn't like to necessarily play one side, they play all sides. So it's like, how do they know who's going to win the election? Because they put 10 rubles on every person. So they're interested in any particular person and an outcome. They don't take chances, they hedge their bets on all sides. There's an old anecdote about horse races and how do you pick the winner. They just put 10 rubles on all the horses and drink vodka and they're good. But let's think about that. They have forced a situation where somebody would have to act. They have forced any additional support out of the room, which also helps them hedge their bets and make a better deal for resources to get billions and billions consistently. And they've picked out particular very unstable areas in Africa, almost like in a circle, so that they could potentially, if things started going bad for them in Ukraine, they could pull out just as a way to shift focus over there and say, well, now we have to help the Africans. See what happens when we focus on Ukraine as a way to the U.S. so that it creates an argument and an international split and focus. So that, I mean, the answer, I guess you would say, is historically based, they have set up for all potential situations so that they can kind of control and manipulate that. I think the United Nations should probably start thinking about this first. If it does start to get stabilized, they'd be better to go in first, but that also, like I said, they control the market kind of in a sense.
The U.S. is not going to send troops in Africa. I mean,
we have them, yes.
A month ago, Blinken went to West Africa to try to diplomatically stabilize our relations in this country. They've been thinking the U.S. has abandoned them. And he left. I mean, the diplomacy from the U.S. is the carrot, the stick is the military. But the U.S. is not going to send troops into Africa at all because it's not politically advantageous right now. So even if Russia left, I mean, Russia being there is not a good thing for the U.S. Even if Russia left, the vacuum probably wouldn't be filled by the U.S. We'd send advisors, but they wouldn't do anything, and it wouldn't mean anything. The U.N. isn't going to go in there. The U.S. is not going back.
So everybody's trying to get at, what does the future look like, and how much planning and how much coordination is there between the Wagner Group and sort of the Ministry of Defense? Sorry, Sarah Darrow from the Department of Energy.
Yes, no, all good.
Yeah, very nice to meet you. Great talk. Yeah, what does the future look like the next 10 years? We've got this destabilized corridor in the Sahel. Could they choose countries with weak institutions that are also resource rich? 10, 15 years down the line, you know, what does this look like for us?
Yeah, it's crystal ball, right? That's a hard question.
Yeah.
I mean, look what's happened since 2013. You know, 10, 11 years later, look how much ground Russia gained on a continent,
right.
Just one continent, right? With the U.S. backing out, France throwing their hands up and leaving, you know, and it's a challenge, right? But they took advantage of weak and fragile states and went in and invested, right? And not only invested their money, but invested the money that they extracted from, resources they extracted from those countries. And there's just a lot at stake for Russia to stay, I think, in Africa. What it looks like for us down the road, I mean, I think, personally, this is just John's opinion, we have to get involved.
Yeah.
You know, we have to get involved somehow. But that model seems to be working for Russia.
Can you talk a little bit more about their resource development, though? You mentioned sort of that they have ownership of a gas field here or a mine there or something to that effect. How effective are they? How good are they at managing? What kind of technocrats do they have involved?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but unfortunately we have a class in this room, so we're going to have to clear the room, but I'd like to...
I didn't know the answer for you, so you
join me in giving Dr. McCarthy a round of applause.